Good morning. Aviators rescued behind enemy lines. The Wall Street Journal takes us inside a daring mission.
In any war, if one of your people goes down in enemy territory, the worst case scenario is the enemy capturing them.
But as Trump celebrated a successful return, he also issued new threats and deadlines to Iran. Also, Axios grades the effects of tariffs 1 year later. And the Artemis II crew are about to go deeper into space than any humans in history.
Sending four humans 250,000 miles away is a Herculean effort, and we are now just realizing the gravity of that.
It's Monday, April 6th. I'm Cecilia Ley, and this is Apple News Today. It's been a perilous and dramatic weekend in the Middle East. The tension ignited on Friday when an F-15 U.S. fighter jet was shot down over southern Iran. U.S. forces found the pilot quickly, but the weapons systems operator wasn't so lucky. He spent 2 days trying to evade capture.
He was in a mountain crevice, essentially. And keep in mind, he had just been shot down, and so he's injured.
Shelby Holliday is a national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. She told us that after the news emerged, Iran put out a reward for anyone who might find the crew member.
And that set off a scramble. I mean, it was really a race against the clock for the U.S. to get him before anyone in Iran could get to him.
If Iran located the U.S. airman first, it would have been a worst-case scenario for the Pentagon. U.S. officials were worried that the regime would use a potential capture for sweeping concessions. Holliday said that at first, little was publicly known about the crew member's condition.
He's trying to communicate and he's following his training. He's by himself. He managed to evade the Iranians. And it's unclear what kind of injuries he has at this point, but we know he was able to move. He was able to move to meet the rescue team. And that in and of itself is described as pretty miraculous.
On Sunday, President Trump posted on social media that the U.S. military had, quote, pulled off one of the most daring search and rescue operations in its history. He said the U.S. had been tracking the crew members' whereabouts and that he had sustained injuries, but, quote, will be just fine. In total, hundreds of special ops and other troops were involved in what turned out to be a massive and risky effort in mountainous terrain. It was the famous SEAL Team 6 that ultimately extracted him, a group that was set up in the wake of the Iran hostage crisis of 1979. The jet was one of two U.S. planes that were targeted in the battle zone. Shortly after the F-15 went down, an A-10, known as a warthog, was taken out by Iran. That pilot was able to navigate the plane outside of Iranian airspace and ejected safely over friendly territory. Holliday says all of this highlights how Iran, despite suffering heavy losses to its military, can still do a lot of damage.
The calculation seems to have changed in that the U.S. is feeling more resolved and more emboldened and more willing to strike targets than ever before. And we've heard that rhetoric out of the president publicly when he's threatening to bomb Iranian infrastructure and bridges and oil facilities. And we're hearing it from sources quietly that this may mark actually an escalation rather than some sort of withdrawal or turnaround in the war.
There were more signs of escalation from Trump's social media feed over the weekend. On Sunday, he posted a series of profanity-laden threats against Iran's power plants, bridges, and other civilian infrastructure if the country doesn't open the Strait of Hormuz by tomorrow. In many cases, these could be considered war crimes. This deadline is one that Trump has issued and extended several times already. It's another shift in his approach to the closed-off strait. Last week, Trump suggested that the shipping route was primarily a problem for other countries to solve. But on Sunday, he told Fox News that he was, quote, considering blowing everything up and taking control of Iran's oil. He will hold a press conference later today with the military in the Oval Office. It's been just over a year since President Trump set out to reshape the American economy with a wave of tariffs, a moment he dubbed Liberation Day.
This will be indeed the golden age of America. It's coming back. We're going to come back very strongly.
Most of those blanket tariffs were eventually struck down by the Supreme Court. But Trump hasn't abandoned them by any means. He continues to target countries while shifting to a more industry-specific approach. Just last week, he signed an order that threatened 100% tariffs on pharmaceuticals if companies don't reach pricing deals with the White House. The administration's efforts are ongoing, but the global trading system has already been upended. Courtney Brown is a senior economics reporter with Axios and has been looking back on the impact of so-called Liberation Day.
I think the most significant way that it's reshaped the American economy is really through the lens of American businesses. They went from a world where the trade landscape looked super steady. There wasn't a question what tariffs were going to be if you were bringing in goods from India. Now it's a totally different story, right?
At a ceremony a year ago, Trump promised that jobs and manufacturing would come back to the U.S. and that consumer prices would fall. Critics, meanwhile, raised the alarms for a possible recession. So far, predictions from both the biggest detractors and boosters have not exactly panned out. Inflation has remained elevated, but far from its four-decade high in 2022. And while there are fewer jobs in the manufacturing sector compared to a year ago, the jobs report on Friday did show some promising signs.
Do manufacturers over the last 3 months, have they been feeling more optimistic? Yes. Does that turn into reinvigorated hiring, decisions to build more factories, spend more money, the types of things that drive GDP growth? We'll have to wait and see.
In some ways, Brown said that the economic predictions were based on what was happening before the Supreme Court's ruling.
At one point, the effective tariff rate was at a peak of 21%, according to Yale Budget Lab. Now we're back down to about 11%. So what would have been the economic effects if we stayed at that peak? We don't know. As far as what's actually happened in the economy, there is evidence, if you look at the consumer price index, that goods prices have risen more rapidly. And when you look at some of the anecdotes from U.S. manufacturers, they were in pain over the past year, and they've only recently started to recover.
Tariffs generated tens of billions of dollars in revenue for the federal government, money Trump has promised will help cover his tax cuts and spending commitments. But now, after the ruling, about half of that needs to be refunded to businesses, and the administration is still working on a plan to figure out how to do it. For businesses of all sizes right now, the challenge is making long-term decisions in an environment defined by short-term whiplash.
Once President Trump leaves office, what happens then? Do the floodgates open and, you know, all these tariffs are beat back and reduced and, you know, I get crushed because now I'm sourcing within the U.S. and it's much more expensive compared to my competitors that might have just hung on and waited for more tariff relief that may or may not come in the next administration.
But by then, global trade may already look very different. As the Wall Street Journal notes in its own analysis, tariffs fundamentally pivoted the U.S. policy away from cooperation and toward using trade as a tool of coercion. And in response, countries have moved faster to strike deals elsewhere. On Sunday afternoon in Phoenix, the UCLA women's basketball team beat South Carolina to win this year's national title.
The Bruins have captured their very first NCAA national championship.
Now it's the men's turn tonight as the Michigan Wolverines and the UConn Huskies square off in Indianapolis for the championship game. At this weekend's Final Four, the 2-seed UConn beat the 3-seed Illinois by 9 points. And in a matchup of number 1-seed Giants, Michigan beat Arizona in a lopsided victory to win a spot in tonight's title game. Michigan is the heavy favorite to win, but that doesn't mean you can count the Huskies out completely.
I definitely think we need to be on upset alert a little bit.
Eddie Pels is a national sports writer for the Associated Press.
Both of the coaches actually made a good point. If this were a best-of-seven series, you'd probably pick Michigan to win it 4-1 or 4-2. But that's the beauty of March Madness, is it's not a best-of-seven series. It's one game. It's who comes in a little bit healthier. It's who comes in with a little bit better plan. Who gets over the jitters.
Pell says a number of key players on both teams are coming into tonight's game with injuries. Michigan star forward Yaxel Lindenborg is dealing with a bone bruise, but says he'll give it a go. Meanwhile, UConn guard Solo Ball was seen in a walking boot after tweaking his left foot during the team's Final Four win. Tip-off for tonight's game is at 8:50 p.m. Eastern Time. The matchup brings to a close another year of March Madness that featured some amazing moments, like UConn's Braylon Mullen's last-second three-pointer to knock off the tournament's top seed, Duke.
Ahead, Boozer, that ball deflected and stolen by Mullins. Caravan, 2 seconds. Mullins tosses it up. Oh! It's good! With 0.3, UConn goes in front.
Despite widespread criticism that college sports is all about money, moments like these make the tournament special for sports fans. Pell says this year's matchups have provided a glimmer of hope for the future of the game.
Nobody's against players getting paid, but there's a spiraling financial picture here that doesn't seem that sustainable. And these players, even though they're getting paid, and even though they might be looking at another school to go to, you know, what we see during these 3 weeks is them giving everything for that team and that school at that time. So it gives you a little bit of hope that this is something worth saving. Now, can they save it? I don't know. We're fixing to find out over the next couple of years, but we love to watch it. And I think that came shining through this year once again.
And finally, some other stories we're following. Thousands of worshipers gathered in St. Peter's Square yesterday for Pope Leo XIV's first Easter Mass as pontiff. In his address, Chicago's own Pope Leo called on global leaders to choose peace. He urged people to, quote, abandon every desire for conflict, domination, and power, and implore the Lord to grant his peace to a world ravaged by wars. And he borrowed a phrase from his predecessor, Pope Francis, as he cited the increasing globalization of indifference. Pope Leo didn't mention any conflict by name, but he has become increasingly outspoken about these issues during the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran. And the Artemis II mission is expected to be on the far side of the moon today, the deepest into space anyone has ever traveled. The crew of four astronauts are on a lunar flyby trip, providing them a view of the moon that can't be seen from Earth. And for a 40-minute period today, the moon will block out connection with mission control, providing a truly unique moment of solitude for the crew. Over the weekend, NASA released new images captured by the team, which show the moon oriented upside down, with its south pole facing upward and parts of its far side visible. The astronauts gave interviews with TV networks over the weekend, sharing their observations hundreds of thousands of miles away from Earth. Here is pilot Victor Glover, the first Black astronaut to travel around the moon, speaking to CBS News after being asked to reflect on Easter Sunday. Like the Pope, he also urged unity and peace.
In all of this emptiness, this is a whole bunch of nothing, this thing we call the universe. You have this oasis, this beautiful place that we get to exist together. I think as we go into Easter Sunday, thinking about, you know, all the cultures all around the world, whether you celebrate it or not, whether you believe in God or not, this is an opportunity for us to remember where we are, who we are, and that we are the same thing and that we got to get through this together.
The crew said it's been a smooth trip overall, except for a few issues, including with their onboard space toilet. If all goes according to plan, they are expected to return to Earth on Friday with a splashdown in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of San Diego. To see those captures of the moon from a new angle, check out the link in our show notes. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the news app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Vox reports on the phenomenon known as looks-maxing, where people take extreme measures to improve how they look and what might happen if we lose diversity of physical appearance. If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.